SF Podcast.
Well, good evening. Welcome tonight. We're taking a bit of a detour from our discussion of Galatians, but what we're going to find out is that it's not really all that much of a detour. This is entitled "This God at the Movies," and it's kind of, I guess, appropriate that we're doing it tonight on Oscar night. The fact that we're talking about the ideas of empire Hollywood is probably the greatest personification of empire in our present day, as we begin to have those conversations of what glamour is and what materialism is and how we begin to struggle with the worship of those things. And we're going to realize in the Revelation passage in your messenger that is in fact the thing that John is calling down. Now, I want to say that on the outset, the idea of God at the movies is not going to be just isolated to tonight. I want to be able to, when movies come out, that kind of address issues that are appropriate for us and we're dialoguing about or seem appropriate that we address them here on Sunday night. So I want to be able to do that. And one thing I've kind of been struggling with is the idea encompassed in this movie, Amazing Grace, which I'll be talking about in a second, are so large. And I just hope that when we come together on Sunday nights, Sunday mornings, even in your small groups, that you don't feel like when we talk about an issue like we will tonight about slavery, and there's so much I want to say, I'm going to try to like just keep it so tight and compact. There's so much to say and so much to talk about. That you don't view it as kind of the end of a conversation, right? Hopefully this is a catalyst to a conversation, to life change. This isn't great. We dealt with slavery last week, and next week we're dealing with something else, and let's just move on. These are huge issues, and I hope that we begin to realize that the gospel is not simply, and what we talk about in this series is not simply about getting individual people to heaven when they die. It's about these issues. It's about kingdom of God coming on earth and how do we reflect and embody the gospel and even doing these amazing things like Wilberforce did fighting his whole life to set captives free. So I want to do three things. The first, I want to deal with William Wilberforce, tell you a little bit about him and about the movie. The second, I want to look at a couple passages from the New Testament that deal with slavery. And the third thing I want to do is have a little bit of conversation about contemporary issues of slavery and how the gospel might address those. So I'll try to do that in 25 minutes. Okay, here we go. The British Empire was economically built on one of the most despicable institutions humankind has ever seen, the institution of slavery. They had plantations in Africa and the West Indies that produced tobacco, cotton, rice, sugar, everything that kind of kept the culture going. And the trade relied on going and kidnapping people from these countries within Africa and to make them ready for the arrival of the slave ships when they would come. So the slave ships would come and then pick up these people and the British would bring them back to Britain and then they would auction them off and sell these slaves to people who wanted them to work in their fields or whatever it may be. And so the entire British Empire was built on this idea. See, sometimes we kind of look at maybe the Wilberforce idea of this guy. Wilberforce was a guy who was working in Parliament and he fought his life. And we'll talk about why he ended up doing this in a minute. But he ended up going on for about 45, 46 years, but 20 years in the Parliament fighting for the idea of the abolishment of slavery. Now, we might think, why would it take someone that long to get people to wake up to the moral issue of slavery? But the reality is that their entire economic world was based on this practice. So think about what it might mean for someone in our world to begin to try to challenge the very foundation of how our country runs economically. That's not going to pass in one parliament meeting, right? That's going to take time. That's going to take dedication. That's going to take conversations and conviction. So these people would arrive, auction these people off. They would transport them from West Africa and Central Africa into the New World. And contemporary historians estimate that some 10 to 12 million individuals arrived from Africa through government permits to Europe, North America, Central America, South America, and the Caribbean islands. However, some put the number of those slaves up to 25 to 40 million. So conservative estimates, 12 million, liberal estimates, 40 million people, okay? Now, this story, Amazing Grace, follows the writer, John Newton, of the hymn, Amazing Grace. And so basically what he was, is he lived 1725 and to 1807. And basically what this guy did is he was a slave trader. He was part of one of these ships. And God convicted him, got hold of him, and he converted to Christ and really began to repent of these issues that he was involved in with the slave trade. And actually, he grew in his faith and grew in his faith to such a point where he became an Anglican minister. And so he left the slave trade, became an Anglican minister, struggled with the past of slave trading. He began to preach against it in his church, and he recognized that the gospel actually forbid it. If you have your messenger there, there's a quote from John Newton under the quote section, the first quote there. Newton, there's a famous story about him in his slave ship. There was a storm going on, and he calls it the Great Deliverance. And in his journal that day, he wrote that the ship was in grave danger of sinking, and he exclaimed, "Lord, have mercy upon us all." And he kind of cried out to God, and this was kind of the beginning, his moment where he began to really think about turning to the Lord. So as a quote there, "The ship in which I was mate left the coast with 218 slaves aboard, and we buried 62 on our way to South Carolina, not counting those which died before we left the coast, of which I have no account." And so he began to really work on, what is this, you know, what was I involved in, and how do I begin to really turn it around in my life? And he began to really focus on the fact that these like in the clip there, these slaves would die on the ship of disease and all kinds of different stuff. And the immorality began to just well up in him. So he became this Anglican pastor. And he began to preach against slavery. And Wilberforce kind of came and went a few times from his church and then got kind of embedded there and heard this message. And Wilberforce at the time was in Parliament. He was already a guy. They said he was a terrier, a debater in the midst of the Parliament. And he was already there. And he comes to Christ. He begins to really get ministered to by John Newton as a pastor. And he begins to really think about how these issues might affect his life. And so he begins to dedicate himself, and if you read the second quote there, in a personal diary, he says, "God Almighty has placed before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of morals in Britain." And so he begins to really focus on this, and he begins to search for God's call in his life, and he feels a clear call to actually abolish these issues. And he fought in the House for 20 years to abolish the slavery. Now, he knew it was radical. Again, what would it mean in our world if someone tried to go in Parliament and challenge the very foundation that our economic structure is based on? They would face a lot of tension. And that's what, I haven't seen the movie yet. The movie comes out in the States. It came out on Friday. And I heard that it comes out in Canada in March. I think March 23rd, right? So go and see this film because it's going to follow his life in an amazing way. So you have this idea of this person who's subverting the empire in his own world. He's saying this is just immoral, it's wrong. So in 1807, Parliament actually voted and abolished slavery. But the work, obviously probably the climax to the film and the climax to Wilberforce's life is that he fought and fought and fought in Parliament for 20 years, and it was abolished. They actually passed a law that abolished the slave trade in 1807. But of course, the work was not done because Wilberforce went on to fight for another 26 years till he died in 1833. Because though the slave trade had actually been abolished, slavery had not been. So the trade in Britain had been abolished, but slavery worldwide and even what Britain was impacting at the time had not been abolished. He knew that the way that they ran their society had implications by default to people, even though the formal slave trade had become illegal. So 3 months before his death, he stood up and spoke publicly to the parliament and said, "I had never thought to appear in public again, but it shall never be said that William Wilberforce was silent while the slaves needed his help." So 3 months before he died, he's still fighting for these people. Now for me, I just sit there and think, God called this guy to something amazing. And he was willing to go out on a limb, to challenge structures, to challenge empire, to challenge the power structures and the centers. I know that the people around him would have said, "Look, William, this is just the way things are. You know, this, we can't do anything about this. You know, the regular person on the street, there's no way things could possibly change here." And it's the same situation that Paul faces. In Galatians chapter 3, verse 28, it's the first passage in your messenger there. Oh, no, I didn't put that one in there. Let me read it to you then. Galatians chapter 3, verse 28, Paul says, "If you belonged, there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, for you are all one in Christ." A little comment that we kind of slip by. This is a huge comment in Paul's world. Paul is dealing with a situation where the Roman Empire of his day, again, is built on the ideas of slavery. I read a very interesting statistic this week. 90% of the people living in Rome in the first and second century were slaves or heirs of slaves, offspring of slaves. 90% of the people living in Rome in the first and second century were slaves themselves or offspring of slaves. An entire empire built on the backs of slaves. And here Paul comes in with the gospel. And he says, the gospel is the great neutralizer. It's the great thing that makes us equal. It comes in and says, listen, and this comment by Paul is subversive to his culture in the same way Williams was. Listen, there is neither slave nor free anymore, because the gospel does not allow us to continue doing slavery. You got to think of, for us, you know, we think kind of movies, right? At least I do, anyway. You probably picked that up by now, though. The movie Gladiator, right? That's a picture of the first century Roman system, and Russell Crowe in that movie is taken into Rome as a slave, and that's why he's fighting. He's fighting for his freedom, right? This is the situation in the world that Paul is speaking into when he says there is no slave, there is no free. The gospel subverts any type of system that will marginalize people in such a way as to oppress them. Paul's saying, if the gospel is changing you, you can't oppress another human being. You can't oppress another human being. The first passage there, Colossians chapter 3, Paul says, there is no Greek or Jew. Again, same type of passage as Galatians. Circumcised, uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is all and is in all. In Philemon, now Philemon is an interesting book, the shortest book in Paul, and Philemon is basically the story of Philemon is a guy who owns a slave, and his slave has run away, and he's met up with Paul. And Philemon is a guy that wants a slave back, and so Paul sends Onesimus, the slave, back to Philemon and sends him with a letter. Sends him with two letters, probably. Colossians and Philemon came together. And so he sends Philemon this letter, and in Philemon he says the most amazing thing. So he sends the slave back. So the slave's freaking out. Onesimus is going back to his slave owner. But Paul says, listen, Philemon owes me favors. Philemon's been changed by the gospel. Don't worry about it. And he sends him back with this letter, and there's this most amazing statement in it. In Philemon, right? The second passage. Perhaps the reason he was separated from you for a little while was that you might have him back for good. No longer as a slave, but better than a slave, as a dear brother. We have to hear the power in that statement, that this man's status is changing in Paul's mind from slave to brother, completely subverting the system and the structures that the empire has on offer. And he continues, he is very dear to me, but even dearer to you, both as a man, as a brother in the Lord. So if you consider me a partner, welcome him as you would welcome me. And then there's a passage in there in Timothy where Paul says, we also know that law is made not for the righteous, but for lawbreakers and rebels, the godly, the ungodly and sinful, the unholy, for those who kill their fathers or mothers, for murderers, for adulterers and perverts, for slave traders and liars and perjurers. Again, this slave trader image, he's condemning slave trading in an empire built on slave trading. I begin to think about what all this means for us today, right? One more passage there in the book of Revelation. Here's Paul looking at the Roman Empire of the day, and he uses the imagery of Babylon from Ezekiel, and he takes the same list that Ezekiel uses of Babylon and Tyre of his own day, and he begins to say, listen, there is judgment coming on Rome, on the way that they do business, on their idolatry and their practices of worship of Caesar and their worship of money. And so he says here, the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargo anymore. Cargoes of gold, silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen, purple silk. And he lists all of these things, right? All of these things that are coming and going by these ships into Rome. The wine and the olive oil and the fine flour and the wheat and the cattle and the sheep and the horses and the carriages. And then like this really haunting phrase, and bodies and souls of men. In these ships, they're not just trading cargo. They're trading human beings. And here's John standing, and he's singing the song of Babylon's destruction. He's saying she's coming down. She's coming down. She's going to be judged by God, partially because of her idolatry and the fact that she's worshiping in Caesar's cult and so on. But here, because of this trading that they're doing, it's become this imperial mindset of worship of the wrong kinds of things. And you're trading human beings, and your condemnation is coming because of it. And the rest of chapter 18 goes on to describe the judgment on Babylon because of her religious and economic idolatries. So what about today? The gospel does not allow the campaign to end slavery end with William Wilberforce or whoever else. In the Christian world, the Canadian Council of Churches is involved in a thing called Canadian Ecumenical Anti-Racism Network. It's an international, and they're also involved in the International Justice Mission and a thing called READ, Resist Exploitation, Embrace Dignity. These are Christian organizations aimed at current forms of slavery. Because believe it or not, slavery still exists. Most of these networks address issues like human trafficking. These organizations estimate that the number of current victims of slavery ranges as high as 27 million people worldwide. Now, if you include India in that, there's a caste system in India which basically has the outcasts. You've heard of the outcasts in India, the untouchables. If you include them in these numbers, you have to add another 250 million people to that equation. So hundreds of millions of people who are still considered slaves in our own day. And I think our tendency here is to begin to say, all right, so there's an issue here. It's the same when we begin to talk about issues in Africa and the third world and so on. There's issues here, but I can't do anything about it. And I'm not doing this to, we're not talking about this as a guilt issue. We're talking about it as an issue of awareness but also as an issue to emphasize the fact, I loved that clip when they said, you know, I understand, William, you're trying to choose between kind of social action and justice in the world and whether you need to be a politician or a man of God or a minister of God. And then she says, we propose that you can do both. And I think that's a beautiful image, because oftentimes we speak about evangelism and affecting the world as one thing, right? We need to evangelize the world over here. And then we talk about social action and justice and doing things for those who need it, the least of these, as Jesus explained it, as another issue. And what the gospel really addresses is the fact that these two issues need to come together. They're two sides of the same coin. You can't have one without the other. They feed each other. The one will not allow you to do one without the other, if we're listening to Paul. And if we're listening to the Spirit of God that says there are still forms of slavery, that if the church doesn't rise up in the image of William Wilberforce and fight until its deathbed for these people, then who's going to? Then who's going to? It can't be our posture and our position to say, you know, the government officials of our world or whatever, they'll deal with it. No. Hopefully they do, and hopefully we can rally them to do that. But the church needs to be doing these things. And I think this community has kind of got that message. And this is, and I'm hoping to inspire us to keep going on it. And so, present ideas. I saw Blood Diamond in my write-up because it was God at the Movies and Oscar night. I put my three top films of the year in the write-ups in the messengers. And number two on there was Blood Diamond. And I don't know how many of you have seen that movie, a very powerful movie that begins, again, a conversation about slavery in a present day, in a contemporary form. And in fact, I was reading up on that whole conflict diamond situation in Sierra Leone, and I found out that 60% of those diamonds that were conflict diamonds represented in that movie during that time were actually purchased by Canadian companies. So this isn't something that we project out to, you know, American Empire or British Empire or whatever. This is you and me. This is our world. You know, and when we begin to think about, money that we put in pensions or whatever, all of this stuff is all connected and involved, right? And I'm just saying we need to begin thinking about, as a community, how do we think about these things in a Christian way? How do we do these things responsibly? How do we make the people who spend our money be responsible with what we are giving them? I want to close with a reading from a book, and I'm not saying you're going to agree with everything I'm going to read. I'm not sure I agree with everything I'm going to read, but I'm reading it. You know, Jesus would speak in hyperbole, right? If your eye causes you to sin, cut it off, cut it out. Well, how many of us have done that? Okay, so you're not a true Christ follower then. Right? Okay, sorry. No, you are still a true Christ follower. But Jesus spoke in hyperbole. He spoke in extreme pictures. And I think sometimes the prophetic role, if we are called to be a prophetic people, the prophet doesn't sit around in nuanced positions. The prophet comes and they go, pow, bang. Wake up. And what it takes sometimes to wake up is a stark image, is a hyperbolic image, an image that shakes us out of sleep, that says, what are you doing? Where are you going? And if you read the prophets in the Old Testament, they did the same thing. And you read Jesus' language as a prophet to Israel of his time, he's doing the same thing. He's speaking these powerful images and messages. And that's what I think what I'm about to read to you does. I want this idea represented here to begin a conversation, not end one. Okay? This is from Brian Walsh from a book called Colossians and subverting the empire. That's where some of this language has been able to integrate into my soul, into my thinking. Okay. He writes, and then he has a person come in and interrupt him once in a while and ask questions. Questions that he feels would be representative of the person reading his book, and then he tries to answer it. I would like to believe that Colossians and Philemon deals with slavery issues, but it raises even more questions for me. I'm wondering what this whole discussion of slavery has to do with our world and how you would translate the question of slavery into the 21st century. What names would you name? Listen to the description of working conditions in factories located in export processing zones where low-wage workers make products cheap. This is a quote from Naomi Klein's book, No Logo. Regardless of where economic processing zones are located, the workers' stories have a certain mesmerizing sameness. The workday is long, 14 hours in Sri Lanka, 12 hours in Indonesia, 16 in southern China, 12 in the Philippines. The vast majority of the workers are women, always young, always working for subcontractors from Korea, Taiwan, or Hong Kong. The contractors are usually filling orders for companies based in the US, Britain, Japan, Germany, or Canada. The management is military style. The supervisors often abuse. The wages below subsistence. The work low skill and tedious. End of quote. Sure looks like slavery to us, Walsh says. What names would we name? Well, just take a look at the tag in the clothing that you're wearing. If that article of clothing was produced in what was just called the economic processing zone, then the odds are pretty good that you can name the brand of clothing you were wearing as a slave trader. And all of us who purchase these goods are thereby complicit in slavery. But let us allow one of the largest clothing manufacturers in the world to explain how this works. Explaining his decision to shut down 22 plants in North America, the president of the American division of Levi Strauss said, quote, shifting significant portions of our manufacturing from the U.S. and Canadian markets to contractors throughout the world will give the company greater flexibility to allocate resources and capital to its brands. These steps are crucial if we are to remain competitive, end of quote. Translation? Move the production side of the operation to economic processing zones where there is no restrictive labor legislations or bothersome environmental protection laws, thereby producing the clothing more cheaply and releasing more resources to the more important local task of advertising the brands. The interrupter comes in. It all sounds rather sinister when you put it that way. There is nothing innocent about economic oppression. There is no room for Christians to be balanced and careful when we're talking about an economic idolatry that will sacrifice children in its service. Slavery is sinister no matter how it gets packaged. Let me read the beginning of that again. There is no room for Christians to be balanced and careful when we're talking about an economic idolatry that will sacrifice children in its service. Then what are we to do? How do we proclaim Colossians and Philemon's liberating word to slaves when they are halfway around the world? It's not as if we have any power over their working conditions. It's not as if they are our slaves who we need to release. But that's just the point. They are our slaves. Every time we step into a Walmart or Nike Town or Gap or Winners, and exclaim over the great deal we can get on an article of clothing, or how trendy we now look. We've made sweatshop workers our slaves. Every time we buy coffee that isn't fairly traded, we've made those coffee producers and their children our slaves. Every time we have purchased a product, any product, that says made in China or Indonesia or the Philippines or Sri Lanka, it is pretty likely that we have made someone our slave. But we have no choice about buying products made in those places. Some things can be bought only from those companies. Buying some of these products is inevitable. And then he closes with this. The language of inevitability is the language of empire. Whenever we hear, we have no choice, our ears should perk up. It is precisely the strategy of the empire to take our imagination captive so that we think we have no choice. When a certain lifestyle seems to be inescapable, you need to realize that you are being imprisoned. The song Amazing Grace that we're going to sing now, it's appeared on 1,100 different albums. It was sang by people involved in civil rights in the freedom marches. Martin Luther King, when he did his I Have a Dream speech, was sung by the crowd. When Nelson Mandela was released from prison, when the Berlin Wall fell at the memorial service for those who died in 9/11, when the New Orleans Saints marched back into the Superdome, Amazing Grace was sung at all of that. And John Newton, who wrote it, became blind later in life, and so the words became somewhat ironic. The issues of, I am blind, but now I see. So think about what we talked about tonight and how the gospel causes an ethic of liberation among the people of God as we reflect on the song and sing it in closing tonight.
This has been the DSF Podcast.